This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars Shadowfall by Alexander Freed. Read for you by Carol Monda. Part 1. Under Ravenous Heavens. Chapter 1. 6 trillion suns and none. One. On Pollinius, where Will Lark was born and lifted into adulthood by the Sun Lamas of the Hickey Matriarch, the word city was synonymous with garden. Settlements on Pollinius grew on canyon walls like moss and sprouted from forest floors, cultivated and tended by their residents. In Cliff, where Will learned to fly the Seravkas, the streets flooded and changed with every monsoon, and the residents rearranged their homes to suit what fate and drainage made of the landscape. Will had traveled to many worlds since leaving Pollinius. On Troyth, he realized he had never truly seen a city before. The engines of his RZ-1 interceptor thundered as he banked away from a massive facade of midnight metal and gold-plated arches, hurtling between towers and under tram lines. Above the lines of digital billboards, solar projectors cast their midday light. Bright against the black sky, they guided Will through the urban labyrinth.
"Tell me you're not running, brother."
The voice coming through Will's comm was barely audible over the noise of the A-Wing. Nath Tenzin sounded amused.
"Not running,"
Will said.
"Circling around."
"That's a big circle. You're off my sensors."
"Maybe because your equipment is older than I am,"
Will returned, but he forgot to smile, and he wasn't listening to himself. He angled his fighter into a cloud of smoke, specks of ash smearing his canopy as he reduced speed. He wrestled with throttle and repulsor controls, looking only at his scanner. Visuals told him nothing, and his stomach lurched as the A-Wing dropped 100 meters and exited the cloud. To his right, a multi-level speeder port rose out of view. Sections of 3 stories spewed jets of flame, the source of the smoke cloud, while crimson particle bolts sprayed another 2 levels, pockmarking metal and chipping duracrete slabs. Will veered away from the flames and into the storm of bolts, watching his shields shimmer as he banked hard and felt his harness bite into his side. He glimpsed pavement far below, and 2 groups clashing along the boulevard, the particle bolts battering the speeder port, and, at the moment, Will's deflector screens were aimed at a UT-60D U-Wing transport hovering 20 meters above 1 group of combatants and unleashing its weaponry onto the second. Will processed the image in less than a second, steering his ship with his body as his vision glimmered with spots.
"Kairos?"
he asked.
"You need an assist?"
He avoided colliding with a metal spire, decorative architecture or obsolete technology, he wasn't sure, as a low tone sounded over the comm. "That's a negative," Will thought, and flinched at the roar of the U-Wing's laser cannons.
"What she needs
Nat's voice again.
Is for us to handle our target. I'm making my attack run in about 10 seconds. You want high or low?
High,
Will replied, and swung his fighter down an avenue perpendicular to the main boulevard. His eyes sorted through structures filling the horizon, domed opera houses and shopping spirals, stacked spheres of cracked crystal that had once hosted sporting events, and focused on the titanic metal fiend striding toward him on four spindly legs. Its arched back led to an insectoid head bearing twitching gun barrels in place of mandibles, and its plating was scored by blaster impacts and coated in dust and ash. Though it was dwarfed by the surrounding buildings, it moved among them like a predator through brass. Will had seen its kind in holograms. He'd heard Satanique and Sonogari tell stories of Imperial walkers marching in platoons capable of leveling spaceports. This particular monster might have been a cargo-carrying model. One of the ground troops had said as much, but one shot would still suffice to incinerate a dozen of the soldiers below. So Will went high, streaking toward the walker's head to seize its attention before bobbing and rolling as energized particles ripped through the air. He went high despite the fact that the walker's fire would, if it failed to obliterate Will, tear into the neighboring structures. It would pierce the domes of opera houses and shatter crystal arenas. It would turn Troyth's history to dust. But it would leave the New Republic infantry intact. Will cut his throttle, allowing the walker's targeting sensors to track him. Cannon blasts screamed loud enough to shake his bones and illuminated the world like lightning. He rocked in his seat, flight helmet smashing against the headrest, and tried to stay one step ahead of his foe.
You see it?
He whispered, and nearly bit his lip as the A-wing jolted.
Nat's coming. Just a few seconds.
A sensor blip grew brighter.
You docking to your ship again?
Nat asked. Will laughed, loud and unembarrassed, as he spotted Nath's Y-wing bomber racing 10 meters above street level. Will flew on past the walker, out of its targeting zone, and the bomber launched its ordnance with the sound of a thunderclap. He looped around, ready to provide covering fire to allow Nath a second firing pass, but crackling arcs of electricity already poured off the now motionless walker's hull.
Ion torpedoes, direct hit.
Nat reported.
Think I got it.
The walker raised a single leg, its metal struts and pistons trembling arthritically. Its head tilted and the machine's weight shifted. Gravity did its inexorable work. Will watched as slow as a leaf drifting from an autumn tree, then swift as an avalanche, the walker toppled to one side. A round tower, walled in broken advertising screens, restaurant balconies, and boutique windows, was poised to receive the brunt of the impact. The falling walker's body connected somewhere around the 7th floor, compacting the building's frame and tearing through metal support beams. Energy continued to ripple across the armored vehicle, briefly causing exposed power conduits and battery stations in the building's wall to flare. As the walker's head struck Durasteel, the structure seemed to undulate, and Will heard a noise like mortars firing as, story by story, the building began to disappear into a mass of rubble and fire. A moment later, the fallen walker burst as if stuffed full of flames. Then it was completely buried. Dust made it impossible to see anything more, though the sounds of collapse and incineration continued. Someone was cackling over the comm.
Pretty sure you got it. Appreciate the help, though.
It was a woman's voice, not one Will recognized. Will brought his A-wing up and around, out of the dust cloud and back toward the ground troops. He forced himself not to look back. His canopy was plastered in soot.
That mean your mission's done?
Nath asked.
Your mission, you mean? We should be getting word from the insertion team soon,
the woman said.
Kinda glad you downed that tower, though. Would have made a perfect sniper nest.
Will checked his scanner, saw no one airborne but Nath and Kairos, then shot a glance toward the boulevard and the infantry. The band of soldiers was cautiously retreating from the blossoming dust cloud and passing out of the shadow of the U-wing.
No civilian sightings,
he said. He kept his voice level.
Not in the 6 hours since we entered the district.
The woman's voice dropped in volume as she shouted orders at her cohorts. Then she resumed.
This all used to be an entertainment center, according to the brief. Big investment when the Empire first came in. Pretty well abandoned now.
Pretty well abandoned wasn't a guarantee.
Understood,
Will said.
We'll hold position until you give the word.
Copy that. And tell your U-wing she's blocking my light.
At this, Will managed to smile. If only there were light to block, he thought. But instead relayed the message to Kairos, who crept barely 10 meters away from the squad. The illumination from the dimming solar projectors seemed no brighter.
Feeling a little overprotective?
Nath asked. Kairos didn't answer. Will caressed his console absently in search of a rattling plate. The dust continued to churn and dissipate. His mind veered between thoughts of the destruction and thoughts of the insertion team descending through the Undercity.
You know, we were careful as we could be,
Nath said. He'd switched to a private channel.
She was a fine-looking building, but not worth tearing up over.
I know,
Will said.
I'll be okay.
Target acquired! 3 imp gorillas bagged, cuffed, and ready for interrogation.
The woman's voice broke through.
Insertion team's done the job you flyboys are 6 tons too heavy for.
Got it.
Will focused on the console, adjusting his communications settings and linking to Troyth's long-range network.
Let's see if we can get a signal out. We've got people waiting.
Two. Astrogation charts called Cerberon a system, and it was, but it wasn't a star system, because there weren't any stars within half a light year. Instead, its planets and moons and asteroid fields orbited the Cerberon singularity, a black hole like a burning eye, its ebony pupil surrounded by an iris of fiery debris. In a few thousand years, Troyth, Katadra, Verzan, and the other worlds of Cerberon would be swallowed by the black hole's gravity, forces more powerful than any Imperial death machine. A few millennia more, and the nearest stars would suffer the same fate. Against the glowing heavens of the dense galactic deep core, the black hole had the distinction of being both the brightest and the darkest object in the sky. Chasna Chaddick wondered how anyone could live in this system and not go mad. It hardly seemed like a place worth fighting for, but the New Republic higher-ups were terrified Cerberon could be used as a shortcut between core worlds, and it turned out being on the winning side of a war meant fighting for stupid things. She tore her gaze from the eye and looked back to the asteroid field surrounding her, carefully rotating the primary airfoil of her B-wing assault fighter from above her cockpit to below. A slab of rock drifted lazily overhead. She'd been flying in atmosphere so often, she half expected to feel the ship tremble in reply. She gave a burst of power to her thrusters, wriggled in her harness, and asked,
"So what was I saying? Before the rocks?"
Through her comm, a woman's voice, rough as a charred bone out of a cook fire, replied,
"The slipglass conglomerate."
"Right,"
Chess said.
"So the Empire gives the Glom total control of transport on Euphornis Minor. Can't get on a tram without chain codes, let alone a shuttle, and I'm stuck way out in the middle of Muckall. What do you think I do?"
"You need a vehicle of your own,"
the voice replied. Chess laughed.
"I do, don't I? So, I've never flown one before, but my host has this old Voltec skyhopper. Barely works. One night he starts asking about my species again, and I decide I'm done. So so I climb aboard and start examining the controls, one button at a time.
The story was a lie. Not every word, but enough to qualify. And she stumbled through it joyfully, concocting increasingly absurd incidents while her ship drifted among the asteroids. She told of an arm-length parasite she found in the Voltec's engine compartment that speared itself on her horn stubs, about maneuvering through a storm while on the run from planetary security, about firing on Glom droids as she landed on the outskirts of a spaceport. She was pretty sure the last part would draw questions. So far as she knew, Voltec had never made a skyhopper with weapons, but no objection came. She squeezed her control yoke as an unexpected flash of crimson flared off her starboard side. She saw fragments of rock tumbling her way and heard the voice say,
"Asteroid might have been trouble for you. Keep going."
Chas shrugged and did as requested. She took the story as far as it could go, ending with,
"Finally made it off-world and managed to signal Hound Squadron. Felt good to be back by the end."
You know that's a lie, she thought. You have to know by now. Hound Squadron wasn't until way later. What will you let me get away with?
I can only imagine,
Erica Quell replied. Chas cackled, threw back her head, and nearly winged another asteroid.
Something funny?
Quell asked, without a trace of irony. Maybe Quell was mocking her, Chas thought. Or maybe she was, for some reason, trying to make friends. Either way, it was entertaining, but not what Chas expected from a woman as fond of chaos as a badly timed belch. She imagined Quell's face, blonde locks tucked into her helmet, jutting nose and tawny skin, eyes straining humorlessly at the darkness.
Nothing at all,
Chas said.
Target's coming into range. We good to go? Ground team gave the signal. Gorillas captured. Didn't get off an alert. Now...
She cut herself off. Chas heard a digitized beeping and an irritated curse.
Still not getting on with the new droid?
Chas asked.
It's fine,
Quell said.
CB9 just wanted to offer input, but as I was saying, now we go after their supplier.
Chas adjusted course and yanked a control lever. Servos issued a grinding noise as her strike foils extended and reshaped the line of the vessel into a cross. She scanned status displays as the computer automatically redistributed power and heat. Ion cannons came online. The primary torpedo launcher registered fully functional. The secondary registered dead, as it had since Pandem Nye. But Chas knew better. If she needed the secondary launcher, it would work. Finally, she adjusted her comm system. A low drumbeat and swift, Hatties-accented lyrics splashed against static and filled the cockpit. Narvath Retro Shutter, from a music chip she'd stolen off a drunk fool in the Western Reaches. Satisfied, she leaned into her seat and let her first torpedo fly. The target was an asteroid the size of an orbital battle station. The torpedo, with a flare bright enough to blind anyone within a kilometer, shattered a small mountain's worth of stone and left the rest of the rock uncracked. Chas loosed a second torpedo before adjusting her systems and spraying particle bolts. She sang as she fired, let the music dictate the rhythm of the violence, and adjusted her vector so that she could batter the asteroid as she passed. Her scanner indicated Quell's X-Wing maintaining its distance on her wing, ready to move in, but not engaging. She watched the torpedo novas, moved to the beat of the music, and periodically checked her depleting munitions supply. She barely noticed her scanner flash until Quell's voice broke through the music.
Fighters on the move. Break away from the rock and check your deflectors.
Chas looked between her scanner and the asteroid. A moment later, she spotted the glinting vessels erupting like a geyser from a chasm, the spout compact closest to the asteroid before dispersing farther out. She counted at least a dozen ships, all basic TIE LN fighters with two broad flat panels protecting the central cockpit eye. In the hands of a skilled pilot, a TIE fighter was a knife, swift and slender and deadly against a lumbering beast like the B-Wing. In lesser hands, Atai was a garbage pail strapped with guns, clumsy and defenseless. Alphabet Squadron had been in Cerberon long enough for Chas to understand what to expect.
"Look at them,"
Chas muttered.
"They can't even stay in formation."
Quell grunted, but didn't disagree. The TIEs broke into separate flights, sweeping away from the chasm as one last ship emerged. A cargo shuttle, boxy and asymmetrical, with a four-winged design out of fashion for decades. Chas called out its coordinates and said,
"Looks like it's running. You want to go after it?"
"No."
"This why we're out here?"
"Yes,"
Quell said.
"With the hideout on Troithgon, we know exactly where it's going, but we can't let it look like we're letting it escape."
Eight TIEs moved between the New Republic fighters and the shuttle, dividing into pairs and sticking close to the rocks.
"Two ways of doing that,"
Chas said.
"We're outnumbered, so we could run like idiots, or we could fight as hard as we can while trying not to win. You know my vote."
Chas expected she knew Quell's vote, too. But anything sounded better than returning home, lying in her bunk, and waiting for the next mission. The Narvath retro shutter came to a close, and a new song, squealed at high speed in a language she didn't recognize, began.
60 seconds of fight time,"
Quell offered.
"If we're hard-pressed, we blow one of the big rocks for cover and bail in the debris shower."
Chas laughed, boosted power to her deflectors, and tumbled toward the enemy. Maybe Quell had changed, but she liked her new commander.
"Deal. Try to keep them off me, huh?"
The TIEs were using the asteroids for shelter. It wasn't a bad plan, but the counter was straightforward. Chas squeezed her trigger and filled the sky with particle bolts, raking the asteroids and sending granite shrapnel flying in every possible direction. Her own shields flickered as she was pelted by stone fragments. If she was very lucky, a shard would puncture an unlucky and unshielded TIE's engine. But all she was really looking to do was make a mess and reduce scanner visibility, and in that, she had succeeded. She called out her target as Quell swept around, attempting to intercept the first pair of TIEs heading their way. Instinct told Chas what could happen next, told her a dozen ways she could win and 50 more she could die. But she'd learned in the past weeks that death was a broken promise. For Zan, the system's airless garrison world had been a fortress that cracked open under the Lodestar's fire and Alphabet's proton bombs. Katadra's temples and palaces had burned as its defenders spat impotent turbo laser volleys. The battle group had seized Troith's main spaceport in less than a day of fighting. In Cerberon, there was no sense that any lost battle could be the last in the war, as there had been with the Rebellion. There was no failure the New Republic couldn't recover from against a scattered and diminished empire. People died, infantry died, but TIEs were in short supply, and death was for the stupid and careless, not for heroes. It wasn't what Chas wanted, but she figured she might as well enjoy it. She adjusted her aim and fired at the first of the TIEs as Quell's X-Wing tore through the second fighter. She hauled her control yoke to port, barely avoided a volley of particle bolts, as her opponent sped past her and, rather than pursue, focused instead on the six fresh enemies closing fast.
"Gotta hit one of them,"
she muttered, and loosed quick pulses at the cluster.
"I'm taking a shot at the cargo shuttle,"
Quell said.
"Hold on."
Chas half snarled, half laughed as the X-Wing slipped between the asteroids and fired wildly at a target she could no longer see. The seven surviving TIEs changed course to surround her. She shot down one, grazed another, and watched emeralds streak past her canopy. One of the nearest asteroids was burning, releasing some combustible gas from a punctured pocket. She put her aft to the flames and wondered how she would survive. She transferred power to her forward deflectors. She wasn't surprised when the TIE closest to her exploded instead of shooting. The dagger of an A-Wing interceptor cut through the blooming flames and then spun about, eliminating another opponent in a single maneuver.
You knew they were on their way?
Chess asked, less irritated than she sounded.
I knew,
Quill said.
You got your 60 seconds.
Chess looked to her console. With the debris still cluttering the scanner readings, she couldn't make out the U-Wing or Y-Wing, but she was confident they were there too.
Good to see you too,
Nath's voice snapped through the comm.
Play us some music and let's save your butt.
The dying animal squeal of Chess's music flooded the comm as Nath Tenzint plotted toward the battle. T5 was reconfiguring his thruster output, but he doubted the droid would squeeze much more out of the aging Y-Wing.
Just keep us steady,
he called, and the ship only seemed to buck harder. If he was late to the fight, he thought, it would be for the best. After hitting the walker, he was short on ordnance. Quell called out orders. Nath snapped off a few shots, coming close to actually hitting a TIE before Kairos, of all people, eliminated his target. She wasn't a showy flyer or a tactical mastermind, and Nath had a habit of forgetting she was more than troop support, but she still packed a punch when on the offensive. Chess, meanwhile, scrapped more TIEs than should have been possible by a B-Wing. By the time Nath came into optimal firing range, all that was left was salvage and an asteroid that burned like a reactor core mid-meltdown.
You never know what's flammable around here,
he said.
We all set? We need to hunt for survivors?
One crashed into that burning asteroid,
Will replied.
I'll do a flyby, check and see.
Poor boy, Nath thought, and shook his head with a smile.
Finish up quick,
Quell said.
Kairos, stay with Lark in case he finds something. Chaddock, sweep for reinforcements on my wing. Zion, scan all comm frequencies and make sure that cargo shuttle isn't sending a distress call.
Will and Chess called acknowledgements. Kairos moved into position. Guess that makes me Zion, Nath mused, but he didn't comment on Quell's slip, and he let T5 scan as instructed. No one else seemed to have noticed.
So you pull off whatever convoluted spy job you and Aiden had planned?
He asked.
I'll let you know when it's done,
Quell said. Soon after, they were finished and en route to Troyth, the five vessels moving in formation out of the debris field and their computer-adjusted velocities locking them in relative position as they swept toward the planet. They crossed over the broken landmass and a neighboring sea, then descended toward one of the unshielded sectors of the sprawling city continent. The solar projectors had dimmed from pale yellow to a twilight blue, suffusing the blur of decaying skyscrapers and disused industrial parks. A testament to millennia of development and transformation and vibrancy that had peaked long before the rise and fall of the Empire. Centuries earlier, Troyth had rivaled Coruscant as the Republic's cosmopolitan jewel, its city encompassing half a globe and teeming with billions of residents, more than a few belonging to the Republic's most respected aristo-mercantile families. Troyth had been the sort of planet the Rust Worlds of the Mid-Rim pretended to be, a place of invention and manufacturing, where a skilled artisan could develop a cognitive module in the morning, attend a trendy concert midday, and oversee the assembly of an innovator droid army at night. Troyth fell away. Coruscant, already the political center of the Republic, had drawn migrants from thousands of Republic member worlds and foreign allies and built sector after sector, level after level of new housing blocks in response. It began to outpace Troyth as an industrial powerhouse by virtue of its greater population, putting hands and minds from countless species to work. And as Coruscant's production had waxed, Troyth's waned due to factors both unavoidable, the exhaustion of precious mineral resources on the broken continent, the Cerberon system's decreasing accessibility in a republic expanding into the colonies and the inner rim, the gradual decay of Troyth's planetary orbit as it spiraled toward the black hole, and tragically preventable, a short-lived civil war between the mixed species underclass and the majority human population, a conflict manipulated in part by an ambitious aristo-mercantile family seeking to profit. By the Clone Wars, Troyth had settled into slow decline. Every year, its billion-strong populace grew a little smaller. Every year, another factory shut down, or another residential district was abandoned. Many of Troyth's inhabitants had welcomed Emperor Palpatine's promises of renewal and restored prominence for their world. Some of those promises had even been kept, and a substantial portion of the population still retained imperial sympathies. That was one reason why the operation to seize Troyth had been slow-going. The skyscraper hills sloped into a basin filled with low metal platforms and webs of scaffolding, along with tents and prefab shelters packing the roads and runways. Past the refugee enclaves came hangars and tarmacs occupied by dozens of freighters, corvettes, and snub fighters. At the very center was the Lodestar, the aging Acclimator-class battleship that had carried Nath and his colleagues across half the galaxy and back.
"You can smell the carbon scoring from here,"
Nath observed.
"Old girl hasn't moved for weeks, and she's still waiting for a good scrubbing."
"Your kind of woman,"
Chas answered with a snort, and laughed to herself at length. Instead of angling for the battleship, the starfighters curved toward a landing pad half a kilometer out, while Kairo split off with her U-wing to join the other transports. 20 minutes later, Nath had lowered his vessel onto the landing pad, briefed his ground crew on his spent weaponry — he didn't trust them with more than basic maintenance — and extracted T5 for recharging. Finally, he reunited with Will under the black sky to begin their trek back to the carrier. Sweat saturated both men's flight suits, though the day was cool and mild. Each carried his helmet under his right arm. Aside from uniforms and postures, they bore little resemblance to each other. Where Nath was broad and muscular, Will was slender. Where Nath's hair was dark, receding, and pulled back, Will's was brown and neat. Where Nath's skin was tinged with brass, Will's was olive-toned. Yet despite nearly two decades separating them, both walked with the swagger of youth. They spoke to those around them more than to each other. As they strode down tarmacs, Will waved encouragement at two Hale Squadron pilots tinkering with their ships. Nath yelled good-natured insults and sly innuendos at passing speeder riders and received grins and riposts in return.
"You see Chas anywhere?" Will asked after a while.
"She's gone wherever she goes after missions. Expect she'll be back by morning."
They didn't see Quell either. Nath assumed she'd already gone to huddle with Cairn Aiden at his makeshift intelligence headquarters. But they crossed paths with Kairos as the Lodestar's hull grew large on the horizon. If the Silent Woman ever sweated, it didn't show through the layers of fabric that swaddled her body or the riveted metal mask that concealed her face. She fell into step beside them as they maneuvered through a field of tugs, load lifters, and equipment crates before marching up the boarding ramp. Inside, the vast hangar mirrored the civilian encampment outside. Rows of multicolored tents, the smell of oil sizzling on heater plates, and the noise of 100 conversations dominated. Soldiers ate and cleaned their rifles and played keep away with someone's crumpled jacket.
"The heroes of Alphabet Squadron," a burly sergeant with a stormtrooper's haircut cried. "You drag yourselves back here looking for applause?"
"We'll take it if you're offering," Nath said.
The sergeant, Nath vaguely recalled the other troops calling him Carver, scoffed loudly, swept his gaze past Will, and then gave a fierce nod to Kairos.
"Only one who deserves it won't be the one to ask. Strike team sends its regards. Good shooting out there."
Kairos didn't seem to hear and strode toward one of the corridors leading off the hangar. For a woman who risked herself for the infantry as often as she did, she never seemed much interested in face-to-face encounters. Will tried to excuse himself next, but Nath gripped him by the arm and pulled him into conversation with Carver and a dozen other ground troops. While Alphabet had been running jobs for New Republic Intelligence, the 61st Mobile Infantry had continued its slow march through the districts of Troyth. The ground war was a war of attrition, and the outcome seemed inevitable, same as throughout the galaxy, really, where there hadn't been a decisive triumph since Pandem Nigh. But the stories were decent enough, and it was best not to get on the infantry's bad side.
"Be charming,"
Nath muttered to Will as a jittery woman named Twitch described knifing Imperial gorillas in an alleyway.
"You get shot down, you're gonna need these people."
"Troyth needs these people," Will returned. "General Syndulla needs these people. I need a shower before we're called out again."
"Suit yourself," Nath shrugged. "I can celebrate for the full squadron."
He could, too. He started to, making an effort to learn the names of Zab and Vitali and Junior, watching for exhaustion and boredom and fervor in the eyes of the grunts as he wove lies about how Alphabet had come together, why General Hera Syndulla had brought them to Cerberon aboard the Lodestar and joined the ground war. He could have gone on for hours, but eventually his comm buzzed, and he was surprised to hear Quell's voice crackle through.
"Couldn't get through to the others," she said. "Pass the word. Briefing tomorrow with the general."
"Good news or bad?" Nath asked.
"Aiden and I have a plan,"
Quell said.
"The convoluted spy job worked, and we got the intelligence we were looking for off the captured cargo shuttle."
"Siding?"
She would know what he meant. There had been no confirmed sightings of the Empire's shadow wings since Pandem Nigh. They didn't talk about the enemy they'd been assigned to neutralize anymore, had avoided the topic insistently since reaching Cerberon, with their efforts to assist the assault broken up only by the occasional inexplicable intelligence op.
"Not exactly."
"What then?"
She didn't speak for long enough that Nath wondered if he'd lost the signal.
"We've been looking at the layout of the Cerberon system. We have the makings of a trap,"
she said. Nath grinned. Quell was a liar, a hypocrite, and a war criminal. But on her best days, the woman had style.
Chapter 2. An Honest Day's Work. 1.
Soren Keyes stood aboard the bridge of the Airy, surrounded by tactical displays and view screens, aglow with charts and status readings. He saw none of them consciously. He allowed his hind brain to absorb the data and translate it into something visceral, staring instead through the viewport of a tie in his mind's eye, listening to the imagined scream of the vessel's twin engines. He saw junk rings glimmering in the sky above Jarbanoff's barren soil and the domes of a colony rising on the horizon like triple suns. From one of the rings, a glittering stream trickled into the atmosphere like a distant waterfall. Leather-winged birds prowled the air, dipping close enough to study the tide before veering off in search of easier prey.
"Squadron 4 is in position now, Major,"
the voice came from the comm.
"What do you suppose we should do next?"
Soren let his eyelids flicker and banished the fantasy. When he returned to himself, he spoke softly and deliberately, observing the reactions of his bridge officers to Captain Gablerone's evident sarcasm.
"Proceed as planned," Soren said. "We have you on monitors and will provide assistance if required."
"Acknowledged, Airy,"
Gablerone replied, before issuing commands to his squadron, calling approach vectors and assigning targets, ordering final systems checks before the violence began. The Airy's bridge crew, meanwhile, concentrated on their consoles and headsets, never glancing toward Soren. He'd met most of them only recently, but he recognized a stiffness to their professionalism. Officers comfortable with their duties showed it in their posture and the ease of their words. Chatter meant communication and cooperation. Quiet soldiers, conversely, were soldiers with unspoken fears. He would return to that later. For the moment, his bridge crew was out of danger. It was his pilots who required attention. Squadron 4 struck its first two targets almost simultaneously. Lieutenant Cedia, the squadron's newest member, transferred and promoted after the death of Drage at Pandem Nye, and her wing strafed the colony's primary disassembly plant. Soren had suggested filling Drage's role with Aaron, but Aaron had died on a mission to someplace called the Auradal Cluster, a loss Soren blamed on his own recent absence. Lieutenant Candende's flight, meanwhile, fired on the battery recycling facility nearly too late to inflict significant damage. Soren would have to interrogate that error during debriefing. Give them time, he told himself, then chastened himself. Time was not on their side. Distress calls going out, Rassus announced from his station on the bridge, glancing backward at Soren. Shall we attempt to jam them? No, Soren said. Rassus opened his mouth to argue, then returned his attention to his console. Question me or be silent, Soren wanted to say. Show confidence for the sake of the others. Perhaps the others wouldn't notice. The fighters continued their brutal work, Gablerone's own flight spraying fire onto the roads and bridges. Soren had timed the attack precisely, allowing the colony's industrial hubs to release their workers from their afternoon shift. Civilian casualties, if one could call colonists supplying the New Republic military civilians, would be higher than if he'd chosen a nighttime strike, but that was incidental to Soren's goal. Fewer workers at their stations guaranteed greater chaos. It was a lesson he'd learned in the aftermath of the Runa attacks years before. The tactics of the Rebel Alliance had struck him as cruel then. Perhaps attacking from a position of weakness required cruelty.
Patrol craft sighted,
Gablerone announced.
Enemies incoming.
As we discussed, Soren answered, do not engage. He turned his attention to the tactical maps and watched the TIE flights increase speed as they wove through the colony. The local militia was confined to atmospheric vehicles. According to the intelligence Soren had been able to obtain, there were no enemy starfighters in system. But so close to ground level, the TIEs had no natural advantage over armored cloud cars. The TIEs took evasive action through the streets, firing on targets of opportunity while avoiding closing range with the patrols. Soren knew his people well enough to understand the restraint they exerted. None of them was comfortable running from a threat. Yet they maneuvered well. Outnumbered and in unfamiliar territory, utilizing tactics they'd lacked even a simulator to practice, they outflew their enemies with ease. An enemy patrol craft disappeared from the tactical map, and Lieutenant Cedia called out the cause. A collision with a garbage silo by an enemy attempting to outflank the TIEs.
Convenient,
she added,
for whatever cleanup crew comes after.
Soren heard pride in her aristocratic enunciation. Afraid or not, doubting or not, the men and women who flew over Jarbanoff were still pilots of the 204th. They were still Shadow Wing. If their execution was imperfect, it was because they'd flown through the gates of hell and returned to fight a war they hadn't trained for. Not because a backwater colony militia could match them blow for blow. How much more time? He asked, striding lazily behind Rassus. 3 minutes, maybe four, the gray-haired major said. Good. Soren clapped a hand on Rassus' shoulder and began to pace the bridge, attempting to project confidence.
He listened to reports of recycling yards burning and junker caravans scattered, updating his profile of Squadron 4 and its pilots. Every call and response reminded him of how much the unit had changed. He had found Shadow Wing decimated, reeling from the loss of Colonel Shakara Nuress, and with a roster of dead longer than any he'd predicted. He'd called Nuress grandmother. They all had once, in sly admiration of the woman who had made the 204th into one of the Empire's finest fighter wings. She had been his friend, and in honor of her memory, among other reasons, he had come to take command, to reshape the unit, after once refusing to shed his blood with his pilots in their darkest hour. His homecoming had been difficult. Command was not what he had been given. He checked the tactical map again.
Captain Gablerone, may I make a suggestion?
Gablerone paused for longer than Sorin would have liked.
Go ahead.
You're outnumbered. Crossfire situations are to your advantage. You may wish to adjust formation accordingly.
I'll keep it in mind, Major,
Gablerone said. Gablerone did not adjust his squadron's positioning, and Sorin didn't press the matter. He had been a different man during his absence from Shadow Wing. He remembered being Devon and mourned the loss. Devon had never truly treasured his own existence, his freedom from all responsibility save for those he chose. He had not appreciated the luxuries of mercy and time.
1 minute, Brassus called. Withdraw your forces when ready, Sorin said.
Devon could never have survived in the 204th. Sorin watched Squadron 4 shake its pursuers and skim the surface of the planet Jarbanoff before rapidly ascending. Cedia hung at the rear of her flight, straying off course long enough to puncture a row of hazard vaults on the colony outskirts, an act Sorin had advised against during planning out of an abundance of caution. He tried to picture how the young lieutenant had bypassed the defenses and made a note to warn the ground crew.
Congratulations, Lieutenant Cedia, he said. You may have just rendered the entire Jarbanoff colony radioactive.
Do you object, Advisor?
Advisor? Her voice suggested no hint of disrespect, but even Gablerone had called him by his rank.
I don't, he said. But I suggest you remain in your cockpit until all trace radiation has been scrubbed from your ship.
I'm comfortable in my flight suit,
Cedia replied.
Proceeding with the extraction.
Someone snickered over the comm channel. The single Republic corvette in orbit would attempt to intercept Squadron 4, but the TIEs had speed and planning on their side. They headed directly for the far side of Jarbanoff's moon, where they would soon rendezvous with the cruiser carrier Allegiance and jump directly to hyperspace. Escape would not be difficult, even if the squadron's discipline appeared lax, which meant Sorin could turn his attention to other matters. He looked from the tactical screens to the viewport, studying the massive junk field where the Aerie drifted. With its systems at low power and the colonists otherwise occupied, the vessel had maneuvered deep into the inner system, dangerously close to Jarbanoff. Jarbanoff was on the outskirts of the Junker systems, not officially affiliated with the Guild, but nonetheless a major processing center for everything from starship wrecks to obsolete planetary mining rigs. It had taken Sorin considerable time, effort, and expenditure of personal influence, but he had managed to make contact with a reliable ally inside the Jarbanoff Orbital Sorting Association.
Do we have a visual? Sorin asked.
Rassus nodded, flipping a switch on his console.
Activating the tractor beam now, he said.
The secondary view screen flashed, replacing an image of Jarbanoff's moon with a low-resolution feed from the Ares main hangar. Beyond the magnetic field, outside the ship, local space was cluttered with unidentifiable plastoid lumps and pitted bulkheads. Moving toward the Aerie, caught in the grip of the tractor beam,
was a salvage sled, an autonomous vehicle 50 meters long, little more than a spindly platform with magnetic clamps protruding from its body like a centipede's legs. As the tractor beam urged the sled closer, the sled's cargo came into view. Attached to nine clamps was the wreckage of nine TIE-LN starfighters. One vessel was missing the solar collectors on its port wing, leaving its naked side albino white. Another lacked its cockpit viewport, as if someone had gouged out its eye. A third TIE had had both wings amputated altogether. All were smeared with ash and carbon scoring, and many dangled cables and piping from exposed wounds. Soren looked from the view screen to his crew. He noted pursed lips, eyes that refused to observe. He voiced the sentiment that he knew was in their hearts. "We risked our lives for these. We risked our colleagues in Squadron 4 and exposed ourselves to attack for... what? Junk?" He shook his head briskly, waiting for Rassus and the others to turn his way. When they did, he continued. "These are our ships. These are the vessels of the Empire, flown by pilots who gave their lives for their brothers and sisters. They will have the chance to fight again. We will make them fly again." He timed his words carefully. He finished as the tractor beam deactivated and the sled gently tapped the deck of the hangar, then transitioned from speech-making to command in an eye blink. "Lock down the hangar and retrace our path through the field. Prepare for lightspeed jump." Thankfully, the crew obeyed. Rassus hadn't yet questioned him openly. Someone whispered, "Let's just burn down a planet already." And Soren felt the air vibrate beneath him as the cruiser carrier's thrusters ignited. Everything he'd said was true. It galled him to stage an operation solely as a diversion, solely so he could claim ships that the Empire would have incinerated rather than repaired, that even the New Republic had deemed unworthy of use. It pained him to put his pilots into action when they were barely a cohesive unit. But the 204th was fragile. He had counted the TIEs and pilots surviving, and neither was sufficient to the task ahead. He could not lead a wing ready to break after a single blow. He could not save his unit without rebuilding it. It would take time, but he would restore Shadow Wing to glory. Chapter 3. Past and Future Glories. 1. I called him Zion. In the middle of an operation, I called Tenzint by Zion's name. I don't think he noticed.
"Would it be terrible if he had?"
the droid asked. It dilated the red dot of its photoreceptor in the accusatory way Erica Quell had grown accustomed to.
"Your squadron is aware of your past inside the Empire."
"Not really," Quell said.
"No, not really."
The ITO unit's spherical black chassis floated roughly 2 meters from Quell, above the emergency driver's pit of the tram car. Quell sat in the doorway opposite, where a heavy barricade should have sealed off unruly passengers from the cab's almost entirely automated controls. But the tram car hadn't run for weeks, not since the New Republic had secured Troyth's primary spaceport, and likely not during the turmoil preceding. And the reprogrammed interrogation droid had taken the car for its office, correctly presuming no one else would need the vehicle. "I remember things all the time now," she said, and it was as difficult a confession as any she'd made. In the Cerberon debris field, Quell's mind had drifted to another mission, a patrol on the outskirts of Cathar, undertaken shortly after her graduation from the Imperial Academy. Back then, she'd discovered during takeoff that her helmet had reeked of creamed longcorn and bile.
She'd been new to her squadron and had said nothing about the stench. When she'd returned to the Star Destroyer Pursuer, it had been another three shifts before Sergeant Grief found her scrubbing her flight suit. As it turned out, half a dozen officers and crew had known about the incident with Zion, who'd grabbed Quell's helmet at a moment of acute nausea. Quell wasn't sure why the mission had dredged up that particular memory, but it had. The memories that came were often of unimportant things, of Shadow Wing pilots who had died a year into her tour of duty, or of the astringent aftertaste of Imperial rations stamped by Aldreg manufactories. Occasionally, she remembered more distressing events, maneuvering through the clutter-bomb-riddled passages honeycombing Tassahandi Station, or the day she'd nearly collided with an ejected rebel pilot in the vast emptiness of space. Sometimes, she thought about how, months before coming to Troyth, when she'd still belonged to the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing, she had taken part in an unforgivable crime. She had abetted, she had performed, an act of genocide on the planet Necronus. Given the opportunity, she'd have continued in her role of murderer, of war criminal, of squadron commander. Only her mentor had saved her from that fate.
"Memory is a construct,"
the droid said.
"For your species, an individual recollection is not a single clear recording, but a reassembly of all relevant data. Before Pandem Nye, you suppressed the keystone to all of your memories with the 204th. Now that you have acknowledged your trauma, it is not surprising other memories would surface."
Major Soren Keyes had told her as they'd surveyed the Necronus wasteland, "If you would do this, then there's nothing that will drive you out." He'd spoken of a moral sickness destroying her and warned that she would stay with the 204th until either the sickness killed her or the rebels did. Keyes had ordered her to leave, and she had. She'd lacked the spine to argue. She'd lied to the New Republic about the circumstances of her defection, lied to her comrades about attempting to thwart the genocide at Necronus, lied to her new superiors, and lied to herself. She'd found that so long as she clung to the fiction of Irika Quell, the righteous woman who'd been pushed too far and tried and failed to stop Operation Cinder, she could hunt down her old friends with barely a twinge of remorse. But now someone knew. The droid knew. She could no longer lie to herself. So she was beginning to remember.
"You witnessed a terrible act,"
the droid went on.
"You feel tremendous guilt, and daily you deceive the colleagues with whom you entrust your life. The notion that this should not affect your health is absurd on its surface. The only question is whether you will permit us to heal the injuries you have suffered, rather than simply ameliorate them."
"I'm here, aren't I?" Quell said.
"You are, and I recognize that important step. Nonetheless, I'm not certain I understand what you expect from these sessions. I wonder if you know yourself."
"I want you to show me how to get my focus back. If you need to medicate me, medicate me." The droid's primary manipulator twitched. The attached syringe was empty.
"Medication is in extremely short supply. I will assist you in functioning day to day, but the symptoms are not the disease."
She stretched out one leg that had been folded beneath her and rubbed at the tattoo on her biceps showing the alphabet crest. She knew better than to argue with the droid. It meant well, but healing was a luxury. The only permanent solution was to finish her mission and get as far away from Alphabet Squadron and New Republic Intelligence and Cairn Aden as possible. Escape the people who knew the truth and the people who would judge her if they knew. "What do you want to talk about?" she asked.
"I'd like to return to the topic of Necronus,"
the droid replied.
"Specifically, I'd like to talk about the story you concocted and some of the details you decided upon. I don't know if you're aware, but you..."
The sound of a fist rapping on metal interrupted the conversation. Quill jerked up, ready to spring to a stand. The droid descended toward the control pit, depressing a toggle and activating the tram's intercom system. A woman's voice came through, low and lightly accented.
Gravas here. I'm looking for Erica Quill.
We're in the middle of a session,
the droid said.
Can we alert you when we're done?
Mr. Aiden's very busy,
the intercom replied.
So's the general. They're ready for her now.
The language was civil, if not entirely courteous. The tone left no room for interpretation. The droid acquiesced without further argument.
Car doors unlocked.
Quell rose, swaying on the balls of her feet, and turned away from the cab. The synthesized masculine voice of the droid called out to her.
You will return tomorrow?
If I can, she said, which was true and vague enough to bind her to nothing.
We can seize the capital, General Syndulla said. The green-skinned woman raised her chin, her headtails bouncing as her eyes swept the room. The only questions are, how long will it take, and how much will it cost?
They'd requisitioned the Lodestar's tactical center for the briefing. It was less formal than the ready rooms, and with the battleship parked planetside, there were no crew members making use of the transparent screens protruding like crystalline stalagmites from every surface. Instead, Quill, Cairn Aiden, and Syndulla stood at one end of a holographic display table, surrounded by flat images of urban topography and imperial bunkers and planetary shield maps. Will Lark, Chasna Chattuck, and Nath Tenzant sat at the table's other end, eyes on the general or roaming the room. Kairos paced, moving from one screen to the next, studying the data. Quell could have scolded her, but she'd accepted months earlier that Kairos was a woman of unusual habits. Besides, she was still shaking off the session with her therapist.
Alphabet Squadron, Syndulla continued, has been instrumental in the progress we've made in Cerberon so far. With Vanguard Squadron on special assignment in the Bormia sector, Alphabet, Meteor, and Hail are all we've got for the remainder of the campaign. However, she looked among the pilots, even locking her eyes with Kairos' visor. I haven't forgotten Shadow Wing. I know you haven't either. Officer Aiden has shared the suspected sightings list with me, and I agree there is a danger.
Quell caught Aiden's glance in her direction. He stood to one side holding a data pad, his antenna stalks nestled in his coiled black hair, and looked simultaneously bemused and smug.
Do we know what they're doing? Tenzin asked.
He started to raise his boots to the tabletop, then appeared to think better of it.
Grandmother's dead. Did they find an imp battle group still active?
Aiden tapped a key, summoning an array of images in orbit around the central holoprojector. The faces of men and women Quell knew as Shadow Wing squadron commanders. An Imperial Star Destroyer, a pair of cruiser carriers. Quell forced herself not to look away, instead staring past the azure light.
We have several theories, Aiden said. We don't think the unit's been absorbed into a larger armada, which means we can assume that they're rebuilding. Leadership would be easier to determine if we knew who survived Pandem Nigh. But you've already seen Quell's roster of likely candidates. Until we have a better sense of their activities, my best guess is Major Rassus.
Quell reached out to touch one of the holographic images, and a middle-aged man with a sour expression bloomed.
Competent, obedient, and never extraordinary enough to draw attention or threaten anyone's sense of ambition. Most likely, he's following Grandmother's last orders and keeping the squadron leaders pointed in one direction.
General Syndulla leaned against the table one-handed, studying the images and expelling a sigh.
Regardless of who's in charge, the threat remains. The last time the 204th followed the orders of a dead leader, millions died on Necronus.
Again, Quell saw Aiden glance her way. She expected him to twist the knife, to mock her with a comment about Operation Cinder only she would understand. Instead, he looked back to the pilots and said, "Quell and I have proposed a plan to General Syndulla that addresses both problems, the situation on Troyth and the threat of the 204th. General, we don't mean to waste your time, but if you could sum up the strategic situation..."
Syndulla swept away the holograms and turned to the screens. "Governor Hastemore remains secure in his residence, with surviving infantry, cavalry, and air force close at hand throughout the capital and neighboring sectors. The system's space force has been virtually eliminated, but otherwise significant military assets remain to our foe. Meanwhile, the shield generators protecting the region are fully operational. Even if there weren't millions of civilians still living in the area, a bombing campaign wouldn't do much good. Ordinarily, then, we would take the enemy sectors surrounding the capital one by one, closing the noose over a period of months. By the end, only the capital sector itself would remain unsecured, and the governor would find himself under siege. We might not be able to starve him out, but we could come blasted close."
She scrolled through maps as she spoke, and Quell watched countless skyscrapers, skyways, gardens, and industrial districts blur together, thousands of kilometers reduced to the stroke of a finger. "This strategy would minimize Allied casualties. It would give the enemy nowhere to run. It would mean that once we took the capital, Troyth would be won."
It wasn't truly that simple, even in the best-case scenario. Troyth wasn't Ryloth or Abednego. It wasn't a world that had been straining under the Imperial yoke long before Endor. Quell had seen Aiden's New Republic intelligence analysts discussing the likelihood of loyalist guerrillas holding out for years, no matter what the outcome of the war. General Syndulla knew it too. One battle at a time, Quell thought. The general continued. "Instead, we're going to move on the capital directly." She swept a finger over one screen, drawing a line from the New Republic territories near the spaceport into Imperial sectors of the city. "We'll need to move rapidly or else be surrounded and cut off. Both ground and air units will be at considerable risk, but the tactical droids agree that our goals are achievable. When the job is done, when we take down the governor and occupy the capital ourselves, the enemy will still control considerable portions of the continent. The planet will be in our hands, but anyone hoping to retake it would see an opportunity." Tenzint was the first to comprehend the implications.
"Hell of a plan," he said.
"You think the 204th would come all the way to the core to retake Cerberon?" Aiden looked to Syndulla. Syndulla nodded to Aiden.
"I'm handling that side of things," he said. "I'll make sure they learn what's going on. They'll know Cerberon is valuable enough to fight for, and they'll know precisely how to take it."
Syndulla picked up the thread.
"We've got an idea of how to tempt them into action. We'll leave a back door open in the planet's defenses, something they won't realize we know about. That looks like the perfect way for a fighter wing to recapture Troyth single-handedly."
"Backdoor have something to do with that last mission? Running down the cargo shuttle in the debris field?" Chasna Chattuck asked. She was slouched forward, elbows on the tabletop and chin on her folded hands.
"Right now the details are need to know," Aiden told Chattuck. "But you'll be briefed when the time approaches. Suffice it to say that we'll be able to predict exactly when and where Shadowwing will appear. I wouldn't worry about the final battle."
Tenzint grinned broadly and nudged Chattuck with his elbow.
"Because whoever heard of a trap going wrong?"
Aiden shot him a furious glance that Quell almost admired for its laser focus.
Chadwick cackled, and Tenzint waved it all off as he said,
I like it, though. I do. If we're taking down the 204th for good, I'd rather do it on our terms.
What about reinforcements? Chadwick asked. For us, I mean. Also need to know, Aiden said. But Lieutenant Quell has put her expertise to good use, and General Syndulla has vetted the plan. No one's going on any suicide mission, Quell said.
She was surprised by Aiden's graciousness, though she assumed it was for Syndulla's benefit.
We can defeat Shadow Wing. We've proven it before. We're just here to finish the job.
Chasna Chadwick looked more bored than reassured. Quell couldn't guess why. Will Lark's fingers were locked together, and he stroked the tabletop as he asked,
Couldn't it go wrong, though?
Aiden began to answer, but Syndulla held up a hand and waited for Lark to continue. After a pause, he did so.
You said this was the riskier path. We almost lost Pandem Nye because we misjudged the situation. What if we endanger civilians again?
Syndulla nodded in acknowledgement.
It's a fair point, but this isn't Pandem Nye,
and we can learn from our mistakes while still judging every situation on its merits. I'm confident the civilian risk, while significant, isn't meaningfully higher than it would be using another approach. Frankly, it's our casualties I'm more worried about. Will began to interrupt, but Syndulla silenced him.
Taking the capital this way, people will die. The ground troops will take hits they wouldn't absorb otherwise, no matter how hard we try to prevent it. But it's a good plan, and in war, any action, inaction included, could lead to losses. We have to decide what stopping Shadow Wing is worth.
She didn't have to repeat herself. Quell heard Syndulla's words echo in her mind. The last time the 204th followed the orders of a dead leader, millions of people died on Necronus. Yet Syndulla wasn't finished. She shook her head gently and amended,
I have to decide what it's worth. That's my responsibility as a general, and I promise you I will do the very best I can.
The tactical center fell silent. Lark still looked troubled, but he nodded to the general. Chadwick shrugged, shoulders rising and falling with an exaggerated breath, even as her eyes were on Lark. Tenzin's gaze held on Quell, and she had to suppress a flinch. He was studying her, watching her, as if he heard the same unspoken words she did. Kairos stood staring at one of the tactical screens. She turned her body slowly, so slowly, like a tree imperceptibly rotating to bring its branches into sunlight, toward General Syndulla. It was Aiden who broke the stillness.
Besides, he said, this whole system's a war zone. We can't make these people's lives much worse.
I thought she'd call our bluff about the sightings, Aiden said afterward at a narrow desk surrounded by printouts in his small office. He grasped the sleeve of the coat slung over the back of his seat and rubbed the cloth over a smudge on the data pad, occupying his attention.
But you were right. It looks like the general is on our side.
It wasn't a bluff, Quell said.
She stared past him, through the semi-transparent walls that looked out onto what had once been the tram tower's control center. Half a dozen beings reviewed data at workstations or murmured to one another in hushed discussion. Most were ununiformed and unarmed. But though New Republic intelligence wasn't part of the military hierarchy,